David Romvet joins the program now. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
Some years ago, you were lucky to have married into a Basque family. I wonder if you could explain what it means to be a Basque new person.
Oh, yes, there's a term in the Basque language, which is called Euskera, which describes a person who learns the Basque language as an adult. And you may be a person who has simply moved, say, as an immigrant to the Basque country or into a Basque diasporic community somewhere in the Americas or in other parts of the world and learned the language. And in that case, you are called an Euskaldun Berria, which means a new Basque human being. A person born to the language, raised with the culture and language, would be called an old Basque person. So you could be a 5-year-old old Basque person and a 50-year-old new Basque person.
Oh, interesting. One of the things about Basque culture that has always, well, that I've admired from afar is their cohesion. Is that your experience of the Basque culture?
That would be a very nice and very positive way to put it. We talk about this with all kinds of people. Sometimes we say, is a community open or closed in some ways? Is it easy to enter or hard to enter? The Basque people have created a community over thousands of years that has in some ways been very insular, and putting it in a more positive light the way you did, it would be one that was simply very cohesive. And that's been, I think, partially because it's a culture that's been attacked many, many times. It's a small culture, has been throughout its entire history, but for one brief period in the 13th century when there was a Basque imperial kind of dynasty. But mostly it's been very small, and it's been in a place where other people have invaded and sought to control the lives of the Basque people. So they've pretty much protected themselves, I think, by being defenders of their own closed community. That's much less so nowadays because there's less pressure. This is my opinion now, less pressure on the culture. It's still difficult to be a small culture in the modern world. But there are protections for people. And, for example, the Basque Autonomous Government in Europe can now allow students to go to school in the Basque language, which was impossible during many, many years of the Franco government in Spain and has been impossible for over 200 years in France. You can, of course, learn the language privately, but you can't go to school the way we do in this country. We know that if we go to an American school, we will have the opportunity to learn in English. The same is true now in the Basque country. A student can learn in Basque. That's a big help, especially given what you asked about new Basque person. The definition is based on language. If you speak Basque, you're Basque.
Well, let's talk about the language a little bit. It's called Euskara. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Hard word, isn't it? It depends. Sometimes Euskara, sometimes Euskara. It depends on the region of the Basque country you're in. But that's the name of the language.
Talk to me for just a moment in Basque. I'd like to hear what it sounds like.
Oh, baina nire izena David dut, hemen bizi naiz, Wyomingen, eta zurekin hitz egiten ari naiz. That basically just said, my name's David, I live here in Wyoming, and I'm speaking with you right now.
The language of the Basque people is a very distinctive language in the world on this planet. Linguists call it an isolate language.
Yes, that's right, which means that as far as we know, there is no spoken family member for the language on Earth. We would guess probably that there must have been related languages once upon a time. And if you go to the very earliest records, when the Romans came into the Iberian Peninsula in the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries of the Common Era, they made a few vocabulary lists, wrote a few things down, and even from that you can tell the language has changed quite a bit. It's recognizable, more so, say, than our language. You know, if we go back to the great epic poem Beowulf, it's incomprehensible to us. We would consider it to be a precursor of English, but no current English speaker could understand Beowulf. Basque has a little more continuity, and maybe because it was a language only in one place, so it didn't have so many influences that it was rocketing around and changing over the last 1,000 years.
Interesting. Now, does it take a different form than Latinate languages? I mean, in terms of declensions and conjugations and all of that?
Yeah, that's right. It, for example, it's a language that uses prefixes, suffixes to do the work of what we do with prepositions and with definite articles. You know, there's no word the, there's no word in, through, of, about. All those are additions to existing words. So the grammar is quite a bit different, and the verb is utterly different than the way a Latin language would think of a verb. It's unbelievable how the verb in Basque can carry all sorts of information that we do with a bunch of explanations. Like the verb can tell you whether a subject is singular or plural, what tense it's in, whether I am speaking to you or you or to me. That's in the verb, not in, I don't have to say you to me because the verb tells me that. It's quite beautiful and elegant and also rather difficult to learn.
Have you ever translated from English into Basque or vice versa?
Oh, I've done a little bit of messing around on my own, of course. We all do that when we're learning languages. But in terms of my work as a writer, you know, mostly people feel that it's not very wise to try to translate into a language that isn't your native language. Mm-hmm. So translators may work with 2, 3, 5, 10 languages into their native language, but rarely would we, like me, I would never try to publish a Basque poem that was translated from English. I would get a Basque native speaker to do that. Maybe we'd work together, you know. But I would translate from Basque into English and have done that a little.
I'm wondering if your experience of Basque has affected your poetics. You are a poet, a novelist, an essayist. Has the language affected the way that you produce your art?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't think so. Maybe only because I'm old. And so I have so many years of working with my own language, and I really do think of the languages to some degree as separate, although you might be leading to this. I often feel as though at some point all the languages start to feel like one big language, and it's just that some of our neighbors only use parts of it and others use other parts of it. Sometimes I'm befuddled, and especially, oh my goodness, in learning Basque in the southern Basque country, which is inside Spain, that means that the other large language right there is Spanish, and so you tend to use them a lot together. You know the way we have Spanglish in the United States, because people will know both Spanish and English. You're in Colorado, right?
Yes.
So you have, I'm sure, a lot of Spanglish speakers in your area.
Yes.
And in the Basque country, there are a lot of people who speak Spanish and Basque equally fluently, and they just talk about speaking Euskanyol, a cross of Spanish and Basque. And I tend, for example, if someone speaks to me in Spanish, I have to stop myself. I often answer in Basque because it would be completely normal in the Basque country to have that happen, but not here. If a Mexican-American person speaks to me in Arizona or Colorado or New Mexico in Spanish and I answer in Basque, we're both up a creek because that person's not going to know Basque. So I don't know about the effect on my work. I think I have a sense of what I try to do in my first language, and it's different. Though I actually have written some stuff recently where I incorporate bits of Basque into the English. I did that in a novel that I published a year or two ago, and I'm doing that now with some poems. So maybe you're correct, and it has an influence.
Oh, interesting. How about that? We're speaking, David, because you are performing. I don't know if that's the right word, but you're reading, perhaps, at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in a couple of weeks in Elko, Nevada. And the theme of this year's gathering is Basques. So I'm presuming that's why you're going. And tell me about what attendees at the gathering will see when they come to see you and your daughter.
Yes, I will be at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering with my daughter. And the two of us perform Basque music together quite often. She grew up here, of course, was born and raised in Buffalo, Wyoming, and so has had some relationship to the local Basque community in that time. We will be there as part of what they're calling the theme of Basques and Buckaroos. Their hope is to highlight and bring attention to and help us to see clearly what exactly is the nature of life in the American West. they began very much as cowboy poetry almost entirely. Now I believe that it's a much broadened scope about what is this life in the West historically, what has it meant. Still, rural life is a big focus, but fast ranching in sheep country was often very different than cattle ranching in places where there were no Basques. So they're giving that attention to the event this year, and it mixes with the traditional focus on Anglo-American rural life in the West. But we will, for example, perform Basque music, talk about Basque culture. We'll work with other musicians and writers who have different kinds of centers of attention than we do, to see what is the relationship between the work of Basque artists and the life of Basque people in the West and those who weren't Basque. It's really exciting to me, you know, to be able to go there and do this. We'll work in the Elko Public Schools several days, meeting students, talking about Basque history in the American West. We'll be part of group performances that include Basque dancers and a tradition, it sounds like you're interested in language, called Bertzolariak. And these are rhymed, sung, sort of poems, I guess, or songs. I'm not sure. They use a limited number of melodies, but they are very highly structured in terms of the number of syllables and lines, and they're competitive. Two people stand up, and they get given a topic, like it might be Basques and Buckaroos, and then one of them chants, sings, recites, and finishes the little form, and the next one goes and does it. Often the two kind of joke and make fun of each other a little bit. It's quite incredible, and there will be Bertzolariak at the Elko event, too. So it's going to be hard to know what people make of it since it'll be in Basque.
My understanding is that the national champion, the Basque champion of that, Bertzolari, is a woman, the first time that has ever happened.
Well, she is this year's winner. Yes, it's quite an incredible thing. Try to imagine in the U.S. that if people got up and recited poems and thousands of people came to see them in a hall and sit quietly and listen to them reciting these things back and forth. But they're all improvised. You can't have written them down in advance. And yes, the national winner of that, which was just this December, Mayalan is her first name. I can't remember her last name. I bet you have it written down there.
Not right with me, but I did see that name. Yes.
Anyway, she is the first woman to have ever won it, but not this year. She won it for the first time, 1989, 90?
Oh, wow.
Something like that. So, but she was the very first woman ever to win it, and she has continued to be a big part of that world and now has won it again this year. That's pretty cool.
That is very cool. Now, have you ever seen one of those contests in person?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I was in the Basque Country for the month of November, and that is the time when the preliminaries and semifinals and finals of it are going on, because it goes on for quite a long time. Starts in the late summer, early fall. And there are all these preliminary rounds around the country leading up to this final thing where the last eight people compete in a big giant hall in Donostia, one of the most lovely cities in the Basque Country. So, yes, I would see it. If you turn on the television, you're going to see it. Huh. And if you go someplace publicly, like where I was, every Tuesday night, I would see one of the Bertzolari events happening.
That's just sort of mind-bending, this whole concept.
Yeah.
It's just, it's really remarkable. And, you know, it shouldn't surprise me because, as I said earlier, I've always been attracted to Basque culture. I thought maybe it might have been because they've traditionally been sort of freedom fighters and their uniqueness of their culture and their language. And you mentioned just a few minutes ago about their story, their part in the story of the American West, which is huge. But so I guess it shouldn't surprise me that two people can get up in front of thousands of people and improvise songs in sort of a poetry slam situation.
It is. I would say that the closest thing we have is poetry slam, except that in poetry slam, we still allow people to prepare the work in advance. You know, they write the poem in advance, they memorize it, and then recite it. But here, the people learn a lot of chunks of language, and they can use things, you know. But if you watch a Bertzolari, if you had a chance to come to Elko and see these people, or even if you watch, you know, we can watch Basque television online now in the computer world. If you find one to watch, you will notice that when the I guess you'd call it the moderator, the person who reads the topic out, and they read it very clearly and very slowly, so the competitors are super clear on what it is they're supposed to do. And then you'll watch the first person kind of standing, maybe hands in pockets or at his or her side, and rocking a little left and right, and maybe their eyes are sort of tilted to the heavens, and you can see the whirring of the brain machine going as they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. Another thing that makes it hard is, unlike English, a Basque sentence, the end of it physically is the beginning of it in terms of thought. So in English, I can start a sentence, or in French or in Spanish, and I don't really have to know where I'm going when I start. I can think my way through as I talk. But for me, in Basque, and certainly when I talk to other people, even native speakers, you kind of have to know where you're going to get when you start because of the grammar. So I think that would make it even twice as hard to do this in Basque than it would in English.
You mentioned, David, that you and your daughter are performing Basque music. What characterizes Basque music? What's the instrumentation? Tell me about it.
Well, the oldest music, the records we have, there is a flute in a museum in the northern Basque country, which is on the French side of the Pyrenees, that is dated, carbon dated as 27,000 years old. And it is the same physical structure as a contemporary Basque flute that's called a xistu, a kind of three-holed flute, very widely played. And that flute in the museum was made of bird bone. Now, of course, they're made of all kinds of modern composite materials. So that's one of the oldest musics, is that flute, along with a drum. There's also a kind of double reed instrument that's like an oboe. It's another very, very old instrument. The most, what would you say, socially charged, powerful instrument of Basque identity right now is the two-row tiki-tisha button accordion. And this is kind of funny because we like to think of tradition as something very, very old. But the button accordion did not come to the Basque country until the 1860s with Italian railroad workers. It was introduced and it was immediately taken up by local Basque musicians who loved it for its loudness, its ability to be durable. If you break part of it, it still works. You could play it outdoors at big events and be heard. It became popular immediately. And it wasn't a part of life in much of the Iberian Peninsula, the part that considers itself Spanish. And so it's also identifiable as different and uniquely Basque, even though it's really rather new, you know, 150 years old in a culture that's many, many thousands of years old. So that's a big part of it. And in Elko, there will be, you know, I play that kind of button accordion. My daughter plays violin. That was a big part of Basque music. Of course, the violin's also rather newish in the history of musical instruments, 1,000 years old, say. And that's a tradition that was driven out by the button accordion in the late 19th, early 20th century, and now is being reintroduced. So a big part of my mission, as it were, as an American playing Basque music, is to bring back the button accordion and the violin together. So that's what we do a lot of, and I think it's quite beautiful.
And the lyrics of the songs, are they, what are some of the themes? Are they love and death, or are they political, or what are they?
Of course, there are all those things. Now, we're kind of used to, in the United States, we have an entire broad, commercially diffused music that we see on radio and television, and for the most part, that's all pretty much romantic songs. And mostly we would not see Billboard Top 100 hits that were politically charged, that dealt with maybe major global events. That's kind of not it. But in the Basque country, you would see those lyrics. At the same time, you would see all the kinds of things that are historically a part of any people's music. Songs of joking. There's a really great love song that's mock love, making fun of the looks of the beloved. And then at the end, saying how much you love the person anyway. But, you know, it's clearly a big joke. There are love songs, classic love songs. So I think lyrics can be pretty much a very wide array of subjects in Basque music. And we do some songs, my daughter and I, that make use of all those traditions.
David, before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about the literature that you've produced. At one time, you were Wyoming's Poet Laureate. And I was fortunate to discover essay in Sun magazine that you produced, something about red states and blue states.
I remember that one.
Really interesting, and you touched a little bit on your art, and I want to ask you, in that essay you say literature offers a freedom that is not granted us in normal life. I wondered if that's why you make poetry.
Well, I suspect I would have to admit that that is partially it. As a child, I had what many people would consider a very difficult childhood in terms of the kind of family I was raised in and the relationship I had, especially with my father. And for me, reading as a kid was an escape into worlds that could be better and freer and more beautiful and didn't have the pain of the world that I did live in. So it was always partially escape. You know, for many of us, art, it allows us to escape from the constraints of our daily lives. At the same time, it allowed me to reintroduce what I thought was beautiful into daily life. And for example, I believe that my experience of reading and writing helped me when it came time to be a parent, to recognize what I wanted to do as a father that would be different from my own father's way of handling his children. So that is a really big, big part of what I'm doing as a writer. And I think many friends I have who write or are musicians who write songs still do see that this is a place where we can, to some degree, make life as we imagine it would be most beautiful to have it.
I found several. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I found several of your poems online, and they were very closely observed, very human moments that often had a little moral payoff that wasn't like a grand epiphany. I wonder if you would read a poem for us.
Oh, yeah, sure. Do you have something you would like, or do you want me to just pick something?
Well, let's see. There's the one, I think it was, Sunday Early Morning or something like that.
Oh, yeah, the one about the boats?
Yes, that's a beautiful
poem. Is that
the
one? Yeah, that might be appropriate because that's a newer poem. That's in my most recent book, just came out last February. And it deals with my daughter, with whom I will be working at Elko. So there's some connection there, too.
Great.
Should I go ahead and read you that one?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's called Sunday Morning Early. My daughter and I paddle red kayaks across the lake. Pulling hard, we slip easily through the water. Far from either shore, it hits me that my daughter is a young woman, and suddenly everything is a metaphor for how short a time we are granted. The red boats on the blue-black water, the russet and gold of late summer's grasses, the empty sky. We stop and listen to the stillness. I say, it's Sunday, and here we are in the church of the out-of-doors. Then wish I'd kept quiet. That's the trick in life, learning to leave well enough alone. Our boats drift to where the churring of grasshoppers reaches us from the rocky hills, a clap of thunder. I want to say something truer than I love you. I want my daughter to know that through her, I live a life that was closed to me. I paddle up, lean out, and touch her hand. I start to speak, then stop.
Lesson learned.
we hope. And I think what you notice seems to me really, really insightful. That is, I'm trying to say something as a writer that I think could count for myself and for someone else, that may give us pause, and it can be even a very short pause. When you say it's not a big grand epiphany, but there seems to be some small attention or attention paid to some small detail we might not have noticed or might not have said quite as clearly as we'd hoped to, because I think a lot of life is what's on the tip of our tongue. And we struggle, whether we're a writer or just a human being, to actually say what it is we really mean.
And those small realizations get at the very center of the human experience.
That's what I hope.
Yeah. I remember one of my teachers back in the day said, you always think it's at the tips of your fingers, but it's really in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
And I'm going, okay, I think I get it. But, you know, it's taken me a lifetime to get it, and I'm still getting it.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that is really, really interesting. And I, you know, I've done spent a lot of my life working with young people, and I once was, and now I grow to be an older person, and definitely for a kid in school, a lot of kids would see me as very old. And I think it's important for them to know that you just keep kind of seeing the world open before you all the way through. It's not as though you actually get somewhere. You're always getting instead of having gotten.